Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all. Welcome to the IGO, INGO Access to Curative Rights Protection Mechanisms Working Group call on the 4th of May at 1600 UTC. On the call today, we have George Kirikos, Petter Renforth, Nathan Cole, Paul Tattersfield, Dave Maher, and Philip Corwin. We have apologies from Osvaldo Naboa. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Steve Chan, Dennis Chang, Barry Cobb, Julie Bislund, and myself, Michelle T. Smiter. I would like to remind you all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and I would like to turn the call back over to Petter Renforth.
Thanks, Petter here. Is there any new statements of interest? I see no hands up. So let's proceed to interesting point two on the agenda, the update regarding possible legal expert consultation. And it was interesting to note that yesterday, we had this small cooperation group with IGOs, GAC, and GINASO are representatives to discuss these and other related questions. And to that group, it has been discussions about a possible new legal expert consultation. And yesterday, John Passaro from OECD replied, and what I think it's really interesting is that he said that he took a few days to consult with other members of the core group of IGOs, meaning that OECD, UN, UPO, World Health Organization, WIPO. And first, he made some comments on that have been discussed on the fact that IGOs that have registered trademarks actually can use the current UDRP, and he stated that where IGOs, the mutual jurisdiction provision of the UDRP in fact prevents IGOs from using the UDRP. And then he referred to what has been previously stated from IGOs like the World Bank and United Nations and OECD on this aspect. But on the legal expert consultation, he said that regarding the consultation of a legal expert, my IGO colleagues share the OECD's concern that such an exercise will significantly prolong what has already been an extensive and resource-intensive process. In addition, our past experiences with ICANN make us deeply concerned that such an exercise risks being manipulated against IGO's interests from the formulation of the research question, the selection of the expert, and the choice of jurisdictions to the potential cherry-picking of language from the expert's conclusions once a report is released. We are grateful that you are trying to start a new, less contentious chapter in this saga, but hope that you understand why we are reluctant to embark down this path. So that's the initial note from this group that they, as I read it, they're not supporting an additional legal expert consultation. And then they said that if it's decided to proceed with that, they would naturally expect that the IGOs would be involved in the formulation of the research questions and the selection of the expert in terms of reference guiding the expert's work and the choice of jurisdictions. And they say that, please note already that a survey of 5 jurisdictions out of the 177 states parties to the Paris Convention seems unlikely to give any kind of accurate idea about the scope of mechanism states used to protect IGO acronyms. It seems that basically there is no support for another external expert, but if it's decided, they will of course be more actively involved in that. And I was actually just going to pass over to Phil that also made some comments for less than an hour ago on this topic. So please, Phil.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. And before I comment a bit more about that dialogue that's been going on a discussion group email list, so far as the work of this working group, as you may have discerned from Peter's description, it's really unclear whether this notion of engaging a new legal expert to see whether there's any legal basis for protecting IGO names and acronyms other than trademark is going to go forward. I think the job for this working group is to continue doing what we're doing, which is to review the comments and decide whether the comments we've received on our initial report merit any changes for our final report. And if this other legal group is established, and if we're asked by the discussion group, which includes board members, and if there's some indication from the leadership of GNSO Council that they'd like our delivery of our final report to be delayed for this work, which I think realistically would select an expert, define the project and complete it, you're talking 6 months to a year minimum, I believe, for the kind of very nebulous project they're talking about. We'll deal with it at that time, but I think our responsibility is to continue doing our work. So far as the specific changes, I did respond to Jonathan's email with, I didn't make it personal, but I took issue with his statement that the mutual jurisdiction clause of the UDRB prevents its use by IGOs and quoted the section of our report and the extensive footnote of all the UDRPs that have been successfully brought by IGOs that we took note of where they were not prevented and were not sufficiently deterred. I took very strong exception to his clear inference that we had in any way at this group tried to manipulate Professor Swain's work to come out in a certain way, pointing out that those questions were prepared with the assistance of staff and were modified, in response to Professor Swain's request for clarification, and that we were very careful in the review of the initial draft of his report to ask for clarifications, but really leave it to him as to what the final content would be, not have a heavy hand on that, and pointing out that had the IGOs joined our working group as members, they would have had input into the wording of those questions and the review of that study. And I have repeatedly emphasized that if they're going to go down this path of engaging a new legal expert, that one, I have great concerns about ICANN starting to design alternative dispute resolution procedures for laws other than trademark laws being kind of naturally implicated by ICANN's mission, which is names and numbers, and it's the names part and that implicates trademarks and potentially in domain name disputes. But I'm concerned that if this happens and other groups may come to ICANN and say, we want a private right of action to correspond to this species of national law, that species, and it's not ICANN's job to be the legislature for the DNS. I've also said that if they're going to look at other legal bases, and I'm dubious that any exist, and that if they do exist, no one's pointed them out to us. We're within the board small group calls for over 2.5 years, so they seem to be unknown to anybody if they exist, but that the legal analysis should be restricted solely to laws that confer a private right of action. The UDRP is an alternative to bringing a trademark infringement suit where there's a private right, and we shouldn't start creating alternative ICANN rights for schemes with regulatory government enforcement and no individual right of action. And finally, just this morning, I forwarded the link that I had forwarded to this group the other day of the case that was published Monday by WIPO, in which the tax authority of the United Kingdom successfully brought a UDRP to recover two domain names that weren't being used but potentially could have been used in a phishing scheme or some other kind of scam. So again, as another example of successful use by a sovereign entity of the existing CRPs. So I think, last thing I'll say, I think this whole dialogue has been useful for all the people on the discussion list, because a lot of the things being said are familiar to us in this working group, but frankly, I don't think are as familiar to board members and GAC members who are on that discussion list, and they're starting to see that things are not quite as black and white as asserted by the IGOs when they find out the actual facts of the situation. So I'll stop there, and I think if anyone has comments for Petter and I on what's going on with that discussion group or how we should respond to it, be a good time to speak up. But otherwise, the best thing to do would be get back to our work and move toward preparing a final report. Thanks.
Thanks, Phil. I perfectly agree that especially these latest comments also show that even from the IGO's point of view, it's not perfectly clear that they want to extend the time work even more to add another legal expert consultation. And also, I just before I let George come to the phone, just wanted to also echo again what I said that I heard from Director for Viper before, that they also they want to avoid any policies that will open up for also other name rights than apart from the traditional trademarks. IGOs is one thing, but I mean there are over the world other types of names that are protected, and disputes around them shall probably not be handled in the traditional domain name issue. Stating that, the conclusion from WIPO from that was that they didn't want to add our recommendation in the present UDRP procedure, but rather preferred to have a specific IGO dispute procedure. Yes, George.
George Grigos for the transcript. Yeah, thanks to both Phil and Petter for the great work they're doing representing our working group in that separate mailing list and working group. Question, I noticed most of the discussions on the mailing list in April and May have been in relation to the possible consultation of an external legal counsel. However, is there anything else in that working group going on that we should be aware of? Like, I haven't gone through all the transcripts of the phone calls or the audio, but barring the the external legal analysis, is there anything else that is happening that might impact our work? Thank you.
Thanks, George and Petter here. I would say that apart from the discussion about a legal, an extra legal expert consultation, it has of course been some discussions back and forth on Article 6 tier and why the proposed addition to the recommendations that we have cannot be accepted. So, but otherwise, I can't remember on the straight line that the other right now at least points that we need to pick up for our working group. Mary, your hands up.
Yes, it is, Petter, and that's from the staff perspective. You're right that most of the discussions or any other discussions really wouldn't impact the work of this working group, because primarily the other point discussed in relation to IGOs, particularly in Copenhagen, was in relation to the possibility of a sort of permanent watch service being established for them. That said, and as Petter and Phil will remember, it's fortunate or unfortunate, depending on your point of view, that the discussions in Copenhagen took place on a Sunday evening and we were practically getting chased out of the conference hall. So I do not know if Bruce and the board members who participated will be intending to suggest that those discussions towards the end of the evening could continue, and those discussions included the immunity and arbitration questions. At this point, we've received no indication from Bruce, but I thought I should just mention it because that really is where the actual discussions left off in Copenhagen. We haven't seen any activity on there on the mailing list, so it's just something that we will continue to follow up on. Thanks, Petter.
Thanks, Mary. And I'm not sure if it has been any further discussions on that topic within the council. Mary? Is that a new hand?
Hey, Petter, which topic did you mean? I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. I thought it was a question for me. I'll put it down.
No, I just... Well, you said that we had some issues, some questions left from Copenhagen, and I'm not sure if I haven't seen it in the working group, but I don't know if Phil can say anything about if it has been further discussed within the Genosa Council.
I'm sorry, Petter. What's the question regarding the council?
As Mary said, we had some questions left on the as I noted it on the second party, the arbitration, and so has there been any further questions within the council about this topic in general, apart from the possible additional legal expert consultation?
No, not within the full council meetings. We're below the radar right now. They're aware of the general status of where we are as a working group. We did. You and I had that call with the chair and vice chairs of council to bring them up to. Mm-hmm. In much more detail on what's going on. There was some discussion of the possibility of this legal expert and how we should respond, but if that occurs. But within the full council, no, they're just standing by waiting for us to complete our work.
Yeah, thanks. That's also my conclusion, that we are we're free to continue to work and then see if there will be, after South Africa, if there will be a decision on another legal expert consultation. But let's proceed with our work as it is right now. Okay, so that was the update on that specific issue. And I have to say that I'm not perfectly updated on how far you came last week, but thanks. Here we have the summarizing of possible new facts. and arguments. And I would say that we have discussed already if the support of suggestion to consult an external legal expert. And I think we have agreed upon that we should just put that aside from our point of view and proceed with our work. So at the point of lack of suitability of Article 6 here as a legal basis for standing. We note that the USG you just said that the disagreement between several GAC members, including the US and the IGOs, on whether Article 6 here provide a legal basis and led GAC to advance an alternative basis for protection, such as the existing criteria for registration at the second level in the .INTA top-level domain. This is more of a historical summary. This approach was adopted already in 2012 and has been the basis for progressive exchanges between GAC and ICANN board, culminating in the IGO small group report. And while the IGOs continue to disagree with the U.S. and others over the interpretation of Article 6 tier, the IGOs and the U.S. nevertheless agreed to disagree on the applicability of Article 6 tier and to move forward on an alternative basis, as is reflected in the IGOs small group report. The GAC list was the result of protracted negotiations with IGOs, replacing that list with all IGOs that have complied with the requisite communication and notification procedure as set forth in Recommendation 2. They say it's a game changer in that at least some organizations that proclaim themselves to be IGOs, in fact, are not. As we have said before, and I don't think we have done that, and I'm not sure that we need a new legal expert on that, but we may study a little bit more Article 6 here to make sure that it is in fact not just to send in an application that is stamped and accepted automatically. I presume that it is some kind of reflection on the basis for the applicant. And as we have concluded, it is in fact an international legal identification and sort of name right, even if it's not the same as trademarks. So I'm a little bit I don't automatically accept that using the registration, the registered names of Article 6 ter is a game changer. IPC states that they do not support using 6-tier notifications as an independent basis for standing under the UDRP or URS. The mere notification to WIPO that an entity is claiming 6-tier rights does not provide a sufficient basis for standing to bring a claim. On the other hand, the list assembled by the GAC has even more tenuous claims as a legal basis for standing, while the list was the subject of extensive discussions between GAC and IGOs and was considered by the small group. It is far from clear what method, if any, was used for determining that Maggio has sufficient rights in his name to be standing and be admitted to the list. And that is also my personal point of view, what I've concluded from that list. I haven't seen any specific acceptable international legal grounds for that list. I think it's practical for the purpose it was created for, but now we're talking about something else. We're talking about a dispute resolution policy that will also be whatever solution we came up with, in some cases, will also be handled by local courts, even if the court then decides that they can't handle the case. The identification must be some kind of internationally accepted. And then we come back to Article 6 here. And then we have the GAC-GNSO facilitated dialogue, suggestion made to consult external legal expert. Yes. And that topic we have discussed. So, do we have we are clear to make a conclusion on this topic? I was actually Phil thinking of you because I know that you you have provided some amended wording where Article 6 tier was one of the bases. I don't know if that's what you was going to rephrase now, but please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. Phil, for the record. Yeah, as I stated last week, I think, we're trying to help IGOs in making it easier to establish standing by simply using that notification as a basis for standing to bring a UDRP or URS, but in the tradition of no good deed goes unpunished, we've gotten lots of pushback from IGOs and U.S. government and IPC. I will say I don't agree with the IPC criticism of the GAC list. I think the GAC list is the list that governments have agreed upon of what they regard collectively as authentic IGOs. So the fact that IGO is not on that list of asserted Article 6 tier rights, I think, does raise a valid issue. And I think we'd be best served by scaling back on this recommendation and not having 6 tier be evidence in and of itself of standing, but have it be evidence in support of having common law trademark rights where there's no registered trademark. It simplifies things. It brings it gets rid of the pushback against using this as an independent non-trademark basis, even though it's related to trademark protection, for bringing these curative rights protection actions. It eliminates the need to give any guidance to panelists to look at the 6-tier language in determining whether as a guide to bad faith registration and use in the context of IGO names and acronyms, and just puts everything right back squarely within the traditional trademark analysis. So I think we wind up accomplishing the same thing. We make it easier for IGOs to bring these actions by pointing out that their 6-tier notification can be pointed to as strong evidence of a common law trademark right that is the basis for the action that would leave the whole issue of who's an authentic IGO, I guess, to the respondent if they do respond and they question the authenticity of the IGO or its trademarks. They can bring it up as a legal defense within the context of the action. So that would be my comment there, and I may have a little more to say after we get through the next one, which is number 2 here, relating to recommendation number 3, which also relates to 6-tier a little bit. But I'll stop there and see if other members of the working group have further views on scaling back Article 6 tier notification from being an independent basis for standing to being strong evidence of common law trademark rights.
Thanks. And I see Mary's note have this no substantive test or evaluation of a 6-tier notification is just sent to member states who then deal with that according to their own individual laws. And as the USG comment notes, it is not uniform. And that makes me sorry to say that, but if we can't have Article 6 here as a basic identification, if someone claims that to be an IGO and don't registered by Article 6 here, that will also give automatically a gray zone, I suppose, for some organizations stating that they are an IGO when they may not formally be accepted as an IGO. So we have to also identify some basics to identify a right IGO. Mary's hand was first.
Thanks, Peter, and thanks for reading out the comment. It was just something that came out particularly through the U.S. government comment that it demonstrates that even with a 6-tier notification that's been communicated to member states, it's not clear from that notification alone that the IGO in question would have any kind of rights, whether that be trademark or some kind of unregistered right. And my assumption when the group says common law rights, they mean an unregistered trademark. So in essence, what we seem to be saying is that the appropriate legal basis continues to be trademark. If it's registered, then this is not something we would even consider, but some kind of unregistered right, aka a common law trademark right. So I think that the disconnect here for us is about using 6-tier to evidence that common law unregistered right when we don't know just through that notification that there is such a right. There may be, and there may be in a lot of cases, but it may also be jurisdiction dependent. So that was our concern with using this list. And on a related point, but not exactly the same, what we don't have in this extract from the USG comment is that the USG actually does conclude by supporting the small group proposal where the basis seems to be fraud or deception. So I think the wording there was where the third-party registrant is pretending to be the IGO or in some way carrying out an act of consumer fraud or deception. So to the extent that that's an alternative basis, and that's something that may be part of that consumer protection discussion that we had in Copenhagen, I just thought I'd note that for the record for fullness. Thank you.
Thanks. I don't think we'll have time to come to that point this meeting, but once we come to the suggested IGO dispute resolution procedure from 2007. I just noted that the identification there was a little bit different. It is initially stated that the registration or use as a domain name of the name or abbreviation of the complainant that has been communicated under Article 6 tier of the Paris Convention. So that is Paris Convention. We're talking about the part of that procedure that identifies applicable disputes. But it also says that they make states what this bad faith use could be, and one of the of the points is on the ground that the registration or use as a domain name of a name or abbreviation of the complainant protected under an international treaty violates the terms of that treaty. So I noted that it's not specifically referring to Article 6 here. Obviously, at that time, the group that worked with this also considered that it could be other international treaties similar to Article 6 here. And it once we come to that and to identify, maybe we can use something similar. And I presume Phil has a specific suggestion on that. Over to you.
Well, yeah, thanks, Peter. Phil, for the record. You know, I think the criticisms of Article 6 tier had more weight when we were, if we're going to say it, just providing evidence that you've provided notification of WIPO gives you standing. But if we scale it back to just being evidence that can be evaluated by the panelists of common law trademark rights, they'll examine it the way they do any other claim of common law trademark rights. They can accept it or they can reject it. And also we can, again, we can provide guidance to the panelists. We have in our charter clear authority to change the UDRP or URS if we believe it's necessary. We're not going that far, but to provide guidance to panelists, which they can follow to the extent they wish to, it's not binding, we have no enforcement mechanism, it's perfectly appropriate. It's a much less intrusive form of into the current CRPs than changing any of their substance. You know, I just think Article 6 tier is the mechanism that the nations of the world have set up to for multiple purposes, one of which is to make it easy for authentic IGOs to protect their names and acronyms as national trademark law systems without having to register trademarks. I don't think it can just be dismissed out of hand. It means something. The fact that a member state of the Paris Convention of the or the WTO is not bound to accept an Article 6 tier provided to a particular IGO that's asserted its rights, I don't think is determinative. We don't require a trademark owner to have a trademark in every nation of the world to bring a UDRP. They just need one trademark in one nation. So the fact that an IGO may file a notification, which most states, and our general understanding is most states would implement that if they believe it's an authentic IGO. But if one or two don't accept it, that would go to the evidence of the common law trademark rights and the authenticity of the IGO to be evaluated by the panelists. So I think scaling back to evidence of common law trademark rights that can be evaluated by the expert panelists with some very non-intrusive guidance in our final report, and which could be contested by the respondent, where the respondent does file a reply, is satisfies any due process concerns. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. Yes, Pedro, I agree. If we see Article 6 here as one possible identification of rights for something that is actually impractical than used as a trademark. And I mean, already today, panelists have to local legislation, national law on name rights that it's not specified as their trademark legislation, but that are name rights that can be similar, accepted as trademarks. I mean, apart from company names as such, that is not accepted, but there are a lot of name rights that in practical is actually used as trademarks. And there are also, which we not should forgot, you don't need to have a registered trademark to show your trademark's rights in a UDRP proceeding. So if we use Article 6 here as one example of such base, it should be also, I think, more easy to show that than as it is today for some traditional trademarks to consider if that trademark, as that name, is actually protected by the very local in a small country somewhere in the world name right. But it's not a new problem, so to speak, or issue for panelists to consider in the current UDRP. Okay. Yeah, and as George said, the example Phil gave to the mailing list today also showed it can be non-commercial and still be victorious in the UDRP. Mary.
Thanks, Peter. So staff had a question, and I've tried to put in a note in some shorthand what Phil was saying, and we'll go back and check the transcript. The question we had is that if the group that's been on this call, and I think it's mostly the same group that's been on the last few calls, feels that this is the proposal or the potential final recommendation is going to make on 6TER, what we can do is make notes of this, and either now or when the time comes, as determined by you, Peter, and Phil, we can put that to the mailing list so that all other working group members have a chance to look at the specific language of the final proposal.
Thanks, Mary. Good suggestion. George?
George Krikos for the transcript. Yeah, just to comment slightly on Mary's note in the top left pod, I just want to kind of point out that IGOs don't have to rely just on the Article 6 registration as evidence. They can also provide, you know, so much other evidence. They can point to press releases. You know, they could present the archives of their website. There's all kinds of other evidence that they can use to demonstrate evidence of, you know, the unregistered rights to their name or acronym. So I just want to make sure that was clear. Thank you. Just like anybody else can. Bye.
Thanks. Yes, and I think that's what we have summarized, that Article 6 is one possibility. If you're an active IGO, you probably have the same solutions and same examples as holders of unregistered trademarks. And as in all disputes, you don't need to show that your name is globally well known. It's enough to have to at least to start the dispute to have some kind of trademark related name protection somewhere in the world. And if I don't see any thumbs down for Mary's suggestion, I think it's a good idea to prepare a summary on this topic and send it out to the full list, and hopefully we can have some acceptance, full acceptance on that. Okay, good. Looking at the point B here, I think it's we more or less have discussed this. Alternative, is there a way to scale back recommendation on 6TER? Or have a recommendation that says use of 6TER to establish procedural standing, but it must be coupled with a substantive legal right of some sort. That's more or less what we have concluded so far. So I go to point two. Not appropriate to import Article 6TER into UDRP URS jurisprudence. She stated that this would introduce an additional hurdle for IDO complainants not currently found in the UDRP-URS cases. Not only does this appear to be yet another instance where the initial report has created a UDRP that is designed to fail, this would open the door to importing this limitation into UDRP-URS cases that do not involve IDOs. I would say that that is more of an echo from what I heard from WIPO, I think that if we with the amended language that we have discussed, we have sort of taken away at least the main part of these obstacles, because then we are still talking about more of trademark rights that are established by using marks that are also registered at Article 6 tier names. We're still talking about some kind of trademark protection. And so George says perhaps we can scale back the recommendation to so that it applies only if Article 6 tier is used for evidence. Could be a possibility. And then we have the OECD that recommendation 3 unduly interferes with panelist decision making and proposes an interpretation of Article 6 tier. It does not enjoy consensus. Panelists should adjudicate the cases before them based on the interpretation of the applicable legal principles in the context of the facts at hand. The proposed recommendation would unduly increase the burden of IDOs bringing cases in the UDRP. I don't really see that. It would be the same burden as all complainants have to actually show that they have a right and to identify themselves as a name holder. So the World Bank say it's not clear that this recommendation even makes sense. Mm-hmm. Such a formalistic preliminary determination is not currently required for any commercial claimant before the UDRP or the URS, and none should be imposed on IDOs. There's no reasonable or legal basis to attempt to use the Paris Convention for something that it was never designed to. The provision above applies to the countries of the Union, not to ICANN. Article 6 there was not drafted with ICANN or the UDRP in mind. Now, that's correct. I will say no trademark acts in the world were also designated to domain names, but it works as a ground. My conclusion on these comments is, again, that if we use the amended identification that we have discussed, it takes away most of the negatives from these comments. I'll see if we have, as Mary says, if 6 is not the basis for standing but merely evidence of standing, there is no reason to incorporate the rest of 6 tier into the UDRP, is there? And I'm not 100% sure what you mean with that. Mary, please.
Thanks, Peter, and I think Phil is making the same point in the chat. If I recall correctly, one reason why the working group included this recommendation on 6 tier 1C was the awareness that in our original recommendation on standing, there was a clear awareness that this would mean any IGO more than the ones on the gag list could basically just use the UDRP. So this question of 6201C was an attempt to not only relate it to the 6TER standing, but to try and have some kind of scope limitation, if you like. If we're going to a recommendation where 6TER is evidence of a right of some sort, just as other sources can evidence a right of some sort, then it might be awkward to, or difficult to have 6TER1C, because then we're looking at the difference from the UDRP, where, as you noted, Petter, that is fairly broad in the sense of what panelists can look at in terms of applicable principles of law. So that was the point I was trying to make. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Mary. And as Phil also says, the criticism of item number two are all avoided if we just use 6TER as an evidence of common law trademark rights. And I think that's where we are going to. Themes that that can be actually a rather useful change of our recommendations. Okay, so let's proceed to the number four recommendation, the oppositions. Then we had some setting. Richard Hill says the reason why. Yes, George, before we proceed, yes.
George Gregos, should we have maybe like check marks to see if everybody agrees on deleting that recommendation? Like, I tend towards agreeing that it can be deleted because it's kind of redundant in that it's, you know, very consistent with the second and third prongs of the UDRP, you know, showing bad faith. But we probably don't want to proceed unless we've heard from everybody else that's on the call whether we should agree with it, or are we going to just put it on the mailing list to see that everybody concurs?
Thanks. I saw it more or less a rephrasing of it. Then we send it out, of course, to the full list to have comments. Ponsolette? And Phil, that's a new hand, or?
Yeah, that's a new hand. Could staff remind us of what is in Recommendation 3 before we discuss removing it? I'm not sure that the part that was commented on is the entirety of Recommendation 3. So can staff just remind us of what Recommendation 3 consists of? Because it's not quoted in the footnote.
Hi, Phil. Yes, it's not, and you remind us that we should probably include it as part of any sort of final recommendation or poll that we take of the whole working group. And I'm trying to pull up the report now, but as I recall, Recommendation 3 has to do with the other prongs of the UDRP in terms of the substantive grounds, and it basically mostly would have to do with the bad faith topic, that in that regard, particularly 6TER1C, which talks about the deception issue and the connection to the IGO, that should be something that the panelists take into account when deciding bad faith. Let me pull up the document. I'll paste it in the chat, but I think overall, generally, that seems to be what we were concerned about in Rec 3.
Yeah, hold on. I've got the document open, another tab. Let me... It will cooperate. Maybe I can... Okay, come on. Okay, recommendation.
Okay, thank you.
3, no specific changes to substantive grounds under UDRP or URS upon which a complainant may file and succeed on a claim. Working group proposed a policy guidance document include a further recommendation that panels should take into account the limitation enshrined in Article 6 tier and determine whether registrant as... Yes, I would say we would keep the first part of the recommendation that we don't recommend any specific change. I guess we don't have to say it, but it's already there. There's no harm in saying we don't, since that was a specific part of our charter, and drop the second part, which was the guidance to panelists, which now becomes unnecessary if we turn Article 6 tier into mere evidence to be evaluated by the panelists of common law trademark rights. Everything is brought squarely back within the traditional trademark framework of the UDRP, and there's no need to look at that language of 6 tier by a panelist who would see when they're trying to determine bad faith registration and use. It's analyzed just as it's always been in the trademark context. So my recommendation would be that we keep the first sentence of 6.3, noting that we're not recommending any UDRP or URS policy changes, but and drop the second part.
Thanks, Phil. Yeah, sounds like a good solution. And as you say, it could be good to keep the first sentence just to be clear that we are not proposing any changes. So it's another group working on that topic that will be considered in the nearest future, in a couple of years. So, Mary?
From the staff side, I guess we just had an observation and a suggestion, because if we do indeed move towards this different reliance on 6 ter, then we're not actually recommending any change to the UDRP or the URS at all. It seems that maybe we could have one recommendation that is very specific about how 6 ter can be evidenced, and as part of that explanation, we basically say this in no way changes any of the substance or any of the prongs or grounds of the UDRP or the URS. I say that simply because by retaining the first sentence, it's kind of a non-recommendation. And looking down the road to implementation, and Dennis from GDD is on the call, it may be awkward if we have a recommendation that doesn't have to be implemented, basically. So my recommendation is to bundle that in some way into or as part of the explanation of the 6 ter as evidence recommendation. And, of course, we can develop the language as we go along.
Thanks, Mary. I understand that. And sorry, I don't have that document in front of me, but as I understand it from you, it's not mentioned in any other part of the recommendation. So if that's the only part where we make some statements on how to read Article 6 here as a base, as one of the bases for filing a dispute, then that's, as you say, let's rephrase it in that way. No, Phil, that's the change in oral statement I made a few minutes ago. Oh, okay. Good. Okay. Then we have the recommendation 4, arbitration court. And the order says, or we can rephrase it, a family recommend that the 3-prong test to be urine. Okay. Opposition to recommendation number four. Richard Hill stated that the reason why an arbitration court rather than a national court is appropriate in the case of a claim made by an IGO regarding his name have been exposed many times. Basically, it's not appropriate for IGOs to litigate matters in national courts. Litigation regarding IGO normally takes place in arbitration court for what concerns commercial matters. IGOs have stated repeatedly and for many years that they are unable to use the present UDRP because it requires them to waive immunity of jurisdiction, which they don't wish to do. Some people disagree with this position and think that IGOs should agree to waive immunity or find some other means to use the existing UDRP. Conversely, if there is a significant number of such abusive registrations, then surely consumers should be protected and a UDRP-like process that the IGOs can and will use should be created. And GAC says that the working group's suggestions of a form of workaround is incompatible with the position conveyed by the legal counsels of IGOs, which was provided to the working group as its request. And there are three reasons provided by the OECD. First, the working group incorrectly restates the immunity test proposed by its own legal expert, Professor Edward Swain. And second, the working group misapplies this incorrect test by applying an inappropriate legal standard. The working group's proposed remedy for IGOs concerned about their immunities entails a complicated legal workaround which could undermine both IGO immunities and its ability to defend its rights in its own name. And they also state that we have incorrectly restated the functional immunity test provided by Professor Swain. And they say that the test asks whether in a UDRP proceeding the third party's infringing use would be found to impede an IGO's ability to carry out its core mission. They also said that Professor Swain stated that a functional immunity analysis would typically look to whether immunity concerns activities immediately or directly related to the performance of task due to the organization. This is an important distinction. The immunity analysis, as stated by Professor Swain, does not focus on the potential legitimacy of the third party's claim or on whether the third party's use might interfere with the IGO's core mission, etc., etc. It's important to remember that this analysis assumes a court which interprets IGO immunities narrowly. Even using this strict test, Professor Swain found that an IGO's immunity claim is likely to prevail. And second, the working group applies an impossible-to-attain standard to the test it devised. It established a threshold of legal certainty which will be satisfied only if it can be demonstrated that all courts will necessarily find that an infringing registration impedes the IGO from carrying out its core mission. However, a legal certainty threshold is impossible to fulfill on virtually any issue. And they refer to Professor Swain's conclusion that an IGO's assertion of immunity under the circumstances in question is likely to prevail to be more than sufficient to justify accommodating these immunities in NICAN dispute resolution mechanism. If I take that first, because the next comment is the possibility to file complaint through to a licensee or agent. So what can we say here? As we've seen from Professor Swain's report, and I can agree with that concern also, but that's a fact, that taking the case to a court depending on the nationality and the place of the court, there will be different solutions. Some courts will obviously, as Professor Svein have pointed out, saying that the IGO has not any immunity in that specific court, and they can take the case, and other courts will just kick out the case, referring to the statements of or the status of the IGOs. But again, if we have a separate second phase with panelists dealing with a case there, there is no there's actually still a risk or slash possibility that the other part will take the case to a national court, and then again the court will decide in different ways. Phil.
Thank you, Peter. Let me make a couple of statements here. Number one, I'm usually very supportive of staff, but as we go through this document, I frankly find it unbalanced. We see a column opposition to recommendation number 4. I don't see any summary of all the comments that were filed that were strongly in favor of recommendation number 4 that supported preserving the right of de novo appeal to a court of mutual jurisdiction. I know the business constituency filed one. I know the Internet Commerce Association filed one. I know George Kirikos filed. I know lots of parties filed one. So we're seeing here, number one, just opposition with no counterbalancing summary of the support for our recommendation. And second, frankly, most of these arguments are not new. They're arguments we heard throughout the process. They selectively quote from Professor Swain's memo the part that supports their position without while ignoring other parts, where particularly the part where he said that for the benefits of a less expensive and much faster arbitration process, it would not be unreasonable to require a waiving of immunity, which is not something we've done. We don't go that far. So I think the more on recommendation 4, the more important debate is going to be what happens if the IGO asserts immunity in the subsequent appeal, de novo appeal, and succeeds on that argument. What happens with the UDRP decision? Is it vitiated, or does it go forward to be heard in arbitration form? But I frankly, I don't see this summation as being properly balanced. I don't see most of these arguments as being anything we didn't consider in formulating the initial report. And this working group, after much deliberation, decided that it was not ICANN's place to predetermine what the decision of a judicial forum would be on the immunity question, and that it was inappropriate for ICANN to do that, and that it was inappropriate for ICANN to deprive domain registrants of their existing legal rights under relevant national law. So, I think, frankly, unless there's an upswell in this working group to change its mind on the most basic issue and to decide that we're going to eliminate right of appeal to a court of mutual jurisdiction, which was the whole justification for IGO seeking a separate process to avoid the mutual jurisdiction clause of the UDRP, there's really not much need to discuss any of this further. Our time we better spent on the option 1 and 2 question, where we did get comments, and there was some weight of comments of those who commented in favor of option 2. Let me say two other things. One, on the issue of asserting immunity, it's clearly the thrust of our initial report that question should not be decided in advance, the question of whether an IGO has or has not immunity from a judicial proceeding. It's up to the court, and I think we should, in our final report, make some statement for the guidance of courts in such situations, something that IGOs can point to, that it's our intent that the court determine that question independently, using based on its own national law and its own analytical method, and that an IGO is compelled assent to the mutual jurisdiction clause should be viewed as something which they commit to appear in that forum if an appeal is brought by the registrant, but not one that strips them of the right to assert their legal defense of immunity, just as no party is stripped of any of its rights to assert legal defenses in any subsequent court case. Also, in regard to option one and two, I just want to state for the record that I had a role in drafting the statement of the Internet Commerce Association, which favors option one. I also had a role in providing input to the statement of the business constituency, which favors option two. So I'm either completely conflicted or totally neutral on that question, but I do understand both sides of it very well. And I just want to get that on the record so as we get into that further discussion, no one thinks I'm pushing one point of view or the other, since I had a hand in the drafting of comments with opposite positions on that very important question. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Phil. And if I try to summarize, what you're stating is that if there is a problem that is, cannot be solved by us or ICANN, that has to be dealt with in a court and where the IGO taking the case to a court or have the case to a court is free to state their jurisdictional immunity, and then it's up to the court that handled the case to decide, which will go in some ways in favor of the IGOs, and in other ways consider that the local court can actually deal with the case. And that, having said that, it's not so many UDRP cases actually taken to a court, and there's even less percentage of them that where the cases have been dealt with in another way than the decision of the UDRP, if the decision was to transfer the domain name. Mary.
Thanks, Petter, and thanks, Phil. I should say it's not just you're normally supportive of staff, you are always amongst the most supportive of staff, and we thank you for that. So it's just a note, and I think George has typed the same thing in the chat, that this document really was just meant to extract some of the potential new arguments, and it may be, as you say, Phil, that some retread ground we've already trodden. I'll note that in an earlier discussion, the group had parked the reasons that OECD had given, and once we actually started looking at those three reasons and putting into this table, it became clear to us that this whole section needs to be kind of considered in its entirety and in relation with the possibility of a separate DRP, because there were comments that brought in arbitration into the separate DRP issue as well. So basically our intent was to have this document not replace the public comment review tool where all the viewpoints we hope are represented, but to be read alongside it, possibly because there may be some new facts or arguments that came through some of the comments. So hopefully that's helpful. Thanks very much.
Yeah, just to jump back in, and I know George is waiting. Yeah, that's fine, Mary. And it's unfortunate. The Adobe chat room does not allow us to display the full public comment document and this document simultaneously. So let me pull back a little on what I said a few minutes ago. But the important thing is to remind everybody that our report overall had very substantial support, the initial report, from a wide variety of parties, including both both entities and the contracted party side of the GNSO Council, the registries, and the registrars had strong support from the BC, had strong support from many other private parties and trade groups. So when we're looking at the criticisms, we got to keep the criticism in context. And as we look forward to ultimate council consideration of our final report, we can be fairly confident that we're in pretty good shape with, both the registries and the registrars in strong support of our original report and support from the BC. I don't know how some of the other groups, the IPC has some criticisms. The other groups in the non-contracted side didn't go on the record, but knowing their usual positions, I'm not very worried about this report getting council approval if it goes forward kind of in the amended the form we seem to be heading toward without prejudging our final decisions. So I'll stop there and return the gavel to Petter, and he may want to hear from George now.
Immediately give it over to George.
George Grigos for the transcript. Yeah, I was going to make the same point that Mary made and Phil agreed with. Just going back to the actual comments that we see in the document, I think the comments of Richard Hill, you know, they're not necessarily ones that we haven't already discussed in the working group before. Like, you know, the issue is, you know, should we stand on principle or should we be more pragmatic? You know, what's the harm if you allow only a small number of cases to be ruled by this new DRP? I think though we need to take a principled stand that those are actually the cases that do tend to go to court, the ones that are the more most valuable domains, 2and3letter.coms, where there is a real dispute over whether the EDRP panelist or the URF panelist made the right decision. So we shouldn't be depriving those domain registrants of appropriate relief in their national courts compared to arbitration, which can be the forum where the problem was caused in the first place. But albeit it might be new panelists, but it's still an area where all the jurisprudence might not be as developed as in the national courts. As for the OECD comments, I think the OECD rep, and in that small group, if we go back to those comments that we saw in that separate mailing list, which I linked to before, it seems that they're working under some misinformation, and they seem to be kind of repeating that misinformation. And Phil and Petter kind of countered them on the mailing list appropriately. We've seen them actually using the EDRP and winning, and so it's like they talk about how preventing their use, and it's simply incorrect. And the analysis that they presented, I don't think Professor Swain got it wrong, or the parts that they're picking out from his arguments actually support their case at all. Because I think our own conclusions are fully consistent with those of the Professor Swain report. And I think the broader question is, should we be creating a brand new law, which we would be doing if we created a separate DRP, and that's not something that, we should be, willing to do, because otherwise it would totally, it would be unprecedented. It would be transforming ICANN into its own separate judiciary, which I don't think anybody supports. Well, some people on extremes might support, but we shouldn't as a working group support. Thank you.
Thanks. And I can note that when it comes to option one, I note both from FICB and BC that they basically support option one, but also state that it should be further considered, and we should listen to what IGO's point of views. And as the business constituency says, that if we take option one, then it will be extremely important that its eventual implementation rests upon carefully balanced selection of an arbitration forum and applicable rules for the de novo determination. We also say that option one would effectively be compelling the IGO to waive its potentially valid claim of jurisdictional immunity. The BC remains open to the input on affected IGOs on this matter. Well, I would say if I say it's a problem, but it's what makes that a little bit unclear is that what we hear from at least most IGOs is that they prefer option two. So if we take these recommendations to even if option one seems to be the best one and the most known by also traditional trademark users and domain name users, if IGOs actually, if there is a majority from the IGOs of option two, well, we have to consider that. So I want to hear some comments, some further comments on option one or option two here. George.
George Krikos for the transcript. Yeah, I'm firmly in the option one camp that you need to preserve the people's right to go to court. That's their, you know, they're a fundamental right that would be stripped if we went with option two. I don't support the analysis that they provided that it's, you know, very familiar or that, you know, some of the registrant agreements support it. It's not all registrant agreements that support it. And that's, it's also, you know, they're using an example of where a party voluntarily contracts with an IGO that they knew what they were going into. And so it's a big leap from that situation to the situation we're presented with here, where a totally unrelated party has a dispute which the IGO initiates, and the IGO wants to select the form that's totally uncalled for. And so I think option one is the most natural one that we should support. Also for option, I'll just stick with that as he fills his hands up. Thanks.
Thanks. Before Phil, I give it over to Mary. Are you mute, Mary?
Peter, I'll feed to Phil.
Yeah, Phil.
Okay. First, a comment on this forum. I would like to see this document. Right now, while we have a list of support for option two and quotes from statements, there's nothing about support for option one, and those views are new as well. There's simply a footnote to the box that says some support emerging for option two. There's a footnote which briefly cites some support for option one and doesn't even include a reference to the ICA statement, which I was involved with. So I'd like to see this document have a box on support for option one, just for the sake of historically of having a correct document when we reconvene in the future. Having been involved with both the ICA statement and the BC statement, which take opposite views, I'm comfortable with the analysis which leads to support for option one, that if you didn't have a if you win the UDRP and are going to try to deny the registrant a right for a de novo hearing in a judicial forum by asserting immunity and trying to, and we want IGOs to be able to assert immunity. That's the whole thrust of our document, that their immunity should be decided by individual national courts, not by ICANN in advance. I see the logic to that. I would say there is an equally reasonable rationale for option two, and I would say within ICANN internal politics, I think that if we recommend option one, it will have a very difficult time surviving after we complete our work. I think it will be subject to rather strident criticism within council, and certainly there'll be very harsh GAC advice to the effect that the board will have to consider to the effect, well, you've really put IGOs in a position of, heads you lose, tails I win, and that if they assert their immunity and prevail, they're left without a remedy, even when the initial UDRP panel has found cyber squatting going on. Now, we all know that UDRP panels sometimes make mistakes, that there have been reversals in national courts of initial UDRP decisions. So the UDRP decision is not 100% determinative, but politically, I think the position that an IGO that wins a UDRP is brought into court, successfully asserts immunity, winds up with nothing, and the cyber squatting that was initially found is allowed to continue, is going to be a very tough sell going forward. But if we do go for option two, I would say further, we're going to have to have some more detailed discussion of how that should proceed. It would be my view that WIPO would not be a suitable forum for hearing such cases. It would be perceived as having perhaps a conflict of interest being an IGO, so we need to discuss what's an appropriate forum for this, and ICANN has used other dispute arbitration providers in other contexts for various dispute procedures under the new TLD program. We can look at those, and we're going to have to look at, we had talked in the past about using the UNSA trail rules, but we need to settle on some set of rules. So summing up, I see the logic of option one. I think within ICANN's internal politics, option one faces a very difficult future, that option two would be the way to go if we want to protect the overall report from greater criticism. But if we go to option two, we're going to have to spend time deliberating proper form and proper rules for any such arbitration. And in all of this, we need to remember that the percentage of UDRP cases that are appealed is extremely small, and we have no way of knowing in what percentage of those that are appealed that involve IGOs they would be able to successfully assert immunity. We've simply trying to preserve the right of the judiciary to make that determination. And I'll stop there. I see George's hand up. I'm sure he has some comment on that.
Thanks, Phil. Petr, yeah, just say two words about, I was also assisting in FICTA comments, and as we stated, we think option one is the most practical from a traditional trademark point of view, and also considering the registrants and the domain holders. But as we also indicated, we have to listen also to IGOs in this case, and to came out with a proposal that can be more acceptable for IGOs. It seems that option two is the one that we should work further on. George, quick note, and then I hand over to Mary for the final comments.
Yeah. George Rico for the transcript. I know we're a little bit over time, so I'll be brief. Just for option one, we should point out, though, that we only get to option one under very rare circumstances, and those circumstances even start where the IGO brought the case themselves. You know, if we've already kind of steered people towards the fact that there's that workaround where they could bring the case through the agent, licensee, or assignee, and perhaps we should be more vocal that even the national authorities themselves can be the initiator of the dispute. Like if there's some consumer protection agency in Australia or whatever, they can bring the case for the World Health Organization under that, you know, scenario that Rustompkin raised. So if we make it clear that, you know, the IGOs do have the ability to get that relief, even under option one, because, you know, the national authority can obviously fight the case all the way through. So it's not as though the procedure can be gained by the registrants. You know, there would still be justice for the IGO. It just needs to be, you know, a proper path through the system that we're proposing. Also, if we do go down the option two route, which I, you know, vehemently disagree with, we should perhaps consider grandfathering all existing registrants so that people that are, you know, not willing to agree with the system know that they don't have to go that route. You know, they would still have the protection of the national courts, but that those who are going to be affected by, you know, binding arbitration know about it going into their registrations. So for newly created domains, perhaps option two could apply. But for all existing domain names, you know, going by the creation date, so even if they changed ownership, it would still go by the creation date, they would go under the option number one, where they could definitely have, you know, full recourse to the national courts. Because I think the IGOs were really pushing these kinds of DRPs because they were worried about, you know, cyber squatting in the EGTLDs, which we haven't really seen, but that's been their, you know, their means of, you know, trying to get this through the ICANN system, because they've wanted this obviously since the 1990s and been consistently rejected. So if they're really concerned only about EGTLDs, then we should only apply it to either EGTLDs or to freshly created domains and grant.
Okay. Yes.
Thanks.
Thanks, George. Mary's hand is down. Steve's up.
Thanks, Peter. This is Steve Chan from StackNet. A real quick comment about ICANN 59. Staff has put in a request for a tentative slot. Right now it's scheduled for 27 June, which is a Tuesday. Local time, it's 10:30 to 12. I believe currently it's across from an RDS session, but I just wanted to let the working group know that there is a session request for ICANN 59. Thanks.
Thanks. Excellent. And thanks all for today. See you to next week. Yep.
Yeah. On next week, this is Phil. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. On next week, I want to talk about next week and then the week after. Next week, I apologize for this. I just realized this. Look at my calendar for next week. I need some dental work, and I had this one of these things where you have to schedule it like more than a month in advance, and my appointment's scheduled for 1:30 Eastern time next week, which would be the end time of our call. I scheduled this when we were having 60-minute meetings before we went to 90 minutes, so I can be on next week's call for the first hour and even chair for the first hour, but I'm going to have to leave at about the one-hour mark. So I wanted to note that right now, the call on Thursday the 11th. And then on Thursday the 18th, I'm really not sure at this time whether I'll be able to participate in the call.
The same here.
Yeah, that's the day I'm leaving for the INTA meeting in Barcelona. I have a two-hour GNSO council call that morning, and I have to leave mid-afternoon for the airport. So, and I'm usually running around like a crazy person on the day of departure for a long meeting with last-minute details. So, and it sounds like Petter has the same problem on the 18th, and that also would be a problem on the meeting of the 25th. Well, that's the day after the INTA meeting ends, but people will be traveling back from that meeting that day. It ends the evening before, so I know a lot of working groups are not having meetings that week because of the INTA annual meeting, which gets thousands of participants. many of whom are active in ICANN groups. So we're fine for next week, other than I'll have to drop off the first hour, but we may not have a meeting for a week or two after that, which...
Yeah, as Mary said, do you want to propose a break for 18th and May 25? Unfortunately, I think it will be necessary for practical reasons.
Yeah, I think because of travel to and from the INTA annual meeting, we're going to have to do that. That's unfortunate. It's going to push back our work by 2 weeks and may make it unrealistic for us to have a final report ready pre-Johannesburg, though I think we can be very close. But we just have to deal with the reality of the calendar and competing demands on our time. So my answer to that question would be yes. And yes, of course, we can continue to do some of the work by email.
Definitely. Okay, good. So, good if you can maybe with us for 45 minutes next week, but as we then will be off for a couple of weeks, even if we have email correspondence in between, I think it's good to have a further update and meeting next week. Thanks for today.
Okay, bye all.
Thank you very much.